Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how grape seed extract could extend the life of resin fillings. That's important. University of Illinois. And how cannabis reverses aging processes in the brain. University of Bonn in Germany and Hebrew University in Jerusalem. I'm not talking about smoking marijuana. I'm talking about the active ingredient, the non-hallucinogenic ingredient that is very medically beneficial. Also, dad's involvement with baby early on is associated with the boost in mental development, Imperial College London and King's College London and Oxford University, showing why the father's input is so important when the child is developing. Another good reason to breastfeed is good for your baby's belly. University of California, 30% of beneficial bacteria in infants' intestinal tracts come from breast milk. Can't get that from formula. And nearly 80% of strokes are preventable. Who says? The CDC says, but I'll explain even more. They say, well, you can, but they don't tell you how. Their idea is to take an aspirin. Well, aspirin will lessen the risk of some strokes, but it actually increases the risk of heart attack. So how do you prevent a stroke and prevent a heart attack? I'll give you that protocol. Also today, your boss believes your work skills will soon be useless. I'm going to talk about this the other day. I didn't have a chance to. It's a good piece from the Washington Post from a Danielle Paquette. And also, I want to give you a look at what the millennials are doing and how I think that not just millennials, but all people who suddenly are at a point in their life where they're saying, is there a better way of living? And I say, yes. I'm calling it quality of life experience. And I'll explain why it's not a commune. It's not a cooperative. It's not a kibbutz. It's not an eco village. It's not a shared commune space. It's a whole different concept. But a lot of people are looking there because they can't afford elsewhere. Also today, a look at Trump, his administration, and then from Professor, who, by the way, does an enormous amount of good work out there and some of the best intellectual work in the world, Henry Giroux, on Trump's America. I will be sharing some of my own commentary today on what neither or any of the mainstream administrations, left or right, have done in the past 36 years that need to be done, and they won't come from these people. We're going to have to stop relying upon a two-party system and rely upon ourselves. So I'll give you some of those as well. I have a guest in the second part of our program, and my guest is one of these really interesting people. He is Michael Kimmelman. Now, he's going to talk about the confessions of a Wall Street insider. We're going to take an inside look at the high trader stakes on Wall Street. What's it like to be a hedge fund manager or work in one of the major firms where you're making all that money? Up on my YouTube channel, I have the last filmed interview of the actual Wolf of Wall Street. Now, he was a penny stock trader. He became extremely wealthy and was very powerful in the penny stocks, but he was not in the same place, even near it, as the people at J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, some of the other banking institutions like Goldman Sachs. When I looked at this man's background, I thought, how in the world did he ever get convicted? Because when I looked, I couldn't find that they had actually any evidence against him. So I'm going to ask him, why did you go to jail when they had a FBI informer sitting beside you every day for 2 years? You didn't know it, but he was wearing a wire. They looked at all your phone calls, had nothing there. All your emails, had nothing there. Had people planted in your life, nothing there. Then why were you found guilty? So we'll talk about that. And I don't think we'll have time today. But anyhow, at some point I'm going to play you, it's about 24 minutes long, a very interesting and a very realistic look at what it means to be wealthy and beyond your imagination, have no principles, moral, or character. All the people around you are similar, and they're all making money and partying. And that was The Wolf of Wall Street. I fortunately got to film him to put in the movie Poverty Inc., my documentary, before Martin Scorsese and the film was made about him with Leonardo da Vinci. Also, I'm going to play you a piece today that we haven't heard about. It is, of course, the worst environmental disaster in history. It's the Fukushima waste problem. But someone found something interesting, and we're going to talk about it. So the other audio clips will have to wait. Let's begin. We always begin with the latest on health and healing, always some quality sources. And grapeseed. Now, I'm certainly a major advocate of grapes, grape skin, grape seed, grape juice. Not so much on red wine. Not that it's bad for you, but it's about potency. Yes, you can get resveratrol, and you can get some of the benefit of grape seed extract, but tiny compared to if you just drank a glass of grape juice. In fact, you would have to drink an entire case of wine to compare to what a supplement of the important grape seed extract would give you as far as the anthocyanins. But this is the University of Illinois. A natural compound found in grapeseed extract could be used to strengthen dentin. Now, if you don't know what dentin is, the tissue between a tooth enamel, and it increases the life of the resin fillings. That's according to University of Illinois Chicago College of Dentistry. Now, no fillings last forever, whether it's composite resin or amalgam. And I'm absolutely opposed to all amalgam fillings, the silver fillings, because about 52 to 54% of amalgams are mercury. They say silver, but it's actually mercury. And those emit into your, every time you chew, every time you swallow, every time you have a cold or hot beverage, you're getting some degree of that amalgam going into your bloodstream. Anyhow, a combination of mercury, silver, tin, and other materials are in these amalgams. They're less expensive, and they generally last 10 to 15 years or more. Composite resin fillings are more aesthetically pleasing because the mixture of plastic and fine glass particles can be colored to match a patient's teeth. However, the fillings typically last only 5 to 7 years. Well, in research published in the Journal of Dental Research, a professor of restorative dentistry describes how grape seed extract can make composite resin fillings stronger, allowing them to last much longer. The extract can increase the strength of the dentin, which comprises the majority of the calcified extracellular tissue of teeth, forming the layer just beneath the hard external enamel. And dentin is mostly made of collagen, the main structural protein of skin, and resins have to bind to the dentin, but the area between the two, or the interface, is a weak point, causing restorations to break down. Quote, when fillings fail, decay forms around it, and the seal is lost. We want to resurface and reinforce the interface, which will make the resin bond better to the dentin. And the interface can be changed through the use of new natural materials. And the new natural material is grapeseed extract. So I wouldn't expect your average dentist to know this, but look up a list of the holistic dentists because they're on top of this. From the University of Bonn in Germany and Hebrew University, memory performance decreases as we age. We know that. Cannabis can reverse these aging processes in the brain. Now, this was shown in mice by scientists at the University of Bonn with their colleagues at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Old animals were able to regress to the state of two-month-old mice with prolonged low-dose treatment with the active ingredient in cannabis. So that opens up some new options. For instance, when it comes to treating dementia, the results are now presented in the Journal of Nature Medicine. And like any other organ, our brain ages. And as a result, cognitive ability also decreases with increasing age. And this can be noticed. For instance, in that it becomes more difficult to learn new things or to devote attention to several things at the same time. This process is normal, but it's normal if you live the normal life. It is not normal if you don't. What do I mean? I mean that we actually have a great deal of control over matching our chronological age with our biological aging. So when people start saying, well, I'm forgetting, my memory isn't what it used to be, and I'm 55 years old, well, you may think you're 55 years old because that's your chronological age, but your brain, based upon how much sugar and caffeine and alcohol and inflammatory agents you've consumed through your life, your brain may be 100. So we have to understand we're really two ages. But here's one experiment that showed that we can actually slow down this whole process. Scientists at the University of Bonn and Hebrew University have now achieved this process in mice. These animals have a relatively short life expectancy in nature and display pronounced cognitive deficits even at 12 months of age. And the researchers administered a small quantity of THC, that's the active ingredient in the hemp plant, to mice aged 2, 12, and 18 months over a period of 4 weeks. And afterwards, they tested learning capacity and memory performance in the animals, including, for instance, orientation skills and recognition of other mice. And the mice who were given the placebo, they just had normal age response learning and memory losses. In contrast, the cognitive functions of the animals treated with cannabis were just as good as two-month-old controls. Quote, the treatment completely reversed the loss of performance in the old animals. Wow. So that's based upon years of meticulous research. This is not just something new. It's not smoking marijuana. And by the way, though I absolutely 100% agree that no drug should be criminalized, all drugs should be legalized. I've also gone on the record to say all people in prisons, all people with records now and previous, should have them expunged for any drug-related offense and then set up treatment centers to help these people, because marijuana is not a gateway drug. Alcohol is. And yet there is no prohibition against alcohol in the United States for adults, and there should be. Not a prohibition that you can't get it. I don't believe in prohibition, but rather a much better educational program. In any case, smoking marijuana has some serious side effects, and you never hear this talked about by the pro-marijuana people as if everything about marijuana is good. It isn't. On the one hand, hemp that marijuana is made from is phenomenal. And if we just started to invest in the hemp industries, we could regrow forest in 1/4 the time as a regular forest and more plentiful. One of the strongest fabrics in the world is made from hemp. We could have clothes, furniture, textiles, woods, all made from hemp. In fact, you can make an entire hemp house. Hemp as a protein is one of the most high-quality proteins you can consume. And also, the active ingredient, the actual oils that are extracted from the marijuana, which are not hallucinogenic, but medicinal. There's over 15,000 citations in PubMed on this. So here we have all this work. Brain tumors, seizures, epilepsy, helps all that. So just something to think about. But when you smoke marijuana, you increase your risk of brain cancer and lung cancer. In fact, marijuana is far more carcinogenic than regular tobacco. That's a big negative that people don't talk about. Also, from personal experience, because one of my closest friends was really using a lot of marijuana, and he became completely paranoid and delusional. I mean, he lost it for years. And finally, when his son intervened, said, would I help? Because he never wanted help. I said, fine. It took us almost a year to detoxify his brain to where he could function normally. And in the scientific literature, there are hundreds of papers on what happens if you're a chronic user of marijuana. Paranoia, psychoses, very common. Now, a lot of it says, oh, it's transient. I've seen people where it's not. So just something to think about. Should it be legalized? Yes. Criminalized? No. Should we be focusing more on hemp and the medicinal value of it? Absolutely. A lot of people, unfortunately, because of culture, more often than not, assume that the mother should do all the raising of the child. I'm opposed to this. I believe that children benefit both from the input of the mother and the father, and those energies are very important. Now, this is from Imperial College London, King's College London, and Oxford University. And what they found in this study was that fathers who interact more with their children in their first few months of life could have a positive impact on their baby's cognitive development. And that's important. And because that cognitive development starts early, but it matures later. And they found that babies whose father were more engaged and active when playing with him in their initial months performed better in cognitive tests at 2 years of age. And the researchers suggest that while a number of factors are critical in a child's development, the relatively unexplored link between quality father-infant interactions at a young age is an important one. So, more time for dads to be with their children. Quality time. And another reason people should breastfeed, because according to University of California, 30% of the beneficial good bacteria in the infant's intestinal tract comes from breast milk. Mothers have been told for years that breastfeeding is best. The research bears that out. Now researchers say they have found a new way to help babies by planting good bacteria in their digestive system. And for the study, they used 107 breastfeeding mothers, and the investigators found that 30% of the beneficial bacteria in a baby's intestinal comes directly from the mother's milk. So that's important. Quote, breast milk is this amazing liquid that, through millions of years of evolution, has evolved to make babies healthy, particularly their immune systems. That's according to Dr. Grace Outervokich, professor of pediatrics, chief of infectious disease, UCLA's Battelle Children's Hospital. Our research identifies a new mechanism that contributes to building stronger, healthier babies, and it's that bacteria that the mother is giving them. And finally, 80% of strokes are preventable. That's according to the CDC. And by the way, over 800,000 people in the United States will have a stroke each year, but probably 10 times that number will have microstrokes and not even know it. And what gives you a microstroke more than anything else? Anger. Anger, yelling, rage, losing your temper, that'll kill you. In addition, one person in the United States will die from a stroke every 4 minutes. Even if an individual survives a stroke, it may cause long-term or permanent damage. Now, here's the good news. Most strokes, over 80%, are preventable. I believe over 95% are preventable. And a large percentage of the ones that happen are treated with the right care. Now, what is the right care? Hyperbaric oxygen. As quickly as you can get a person to hyperbaric oxygen, that's how quickly you can stop a lot of the damage and save a person's life. Now, stroke, if you're not aware of it, it's a stroke is a disease that affects the arteries, leading to them within the brain. A stroke occurs when a blood vessel that carries oxygen and nutrients to the brain either bursts, ruptures, or is blocked by a clot. As a result, the brain cannot get the blood and oxygen it needs, and pieces of the brain die. Now, anyone, including children, can have a stroke. And some stroke risk factors are ethnicity, and these are controllable. And there are several risk factors within your control that are easy. Keep your blood pressure down. So if you have hypertension, you're at greater risk of stroke. If you're overweight, greater risk of stroke if you're not exercising, greater risk of stroke. Smoking and a lot of prescription medications also increase your risk of stroke. How would you know if you had a stroke, even a minor stroke? A sudden numbness or weakness in the face, arm, or leg. A sudden confusion or trouble speaking or understanding others. A sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes. Sudden dizziness, trouble walking, a loss of balance or coordination. A sudden severe headache with no known causes. And one easy way to know the signs and symptoms of a stroke is to use the acronym FAST, F-A-S-T, which stands for face drooping. Does one side of the face droop or is it numb? And if you question that, just ask someone to smile and you'll see. Arm weakness. Is one arm weak or numb? Ask the person to raise both arms. Does one arm drift downwards? Speech difficulty. Is speech slurred? Are they unable to speak? Or are they hard to understand? Ask the person to repeat a simple sentence like, the sky is blue. Is the sentence repeated correctly? If there are any of those problems, you call 911. If the person shows any symptoms, even if the symptoms go away, I would still be on the safe side to get them to a hospital. Now, I also believe that you can do a few things on your own, and that would include always having cayenne pepper, high heat, 40,000 units, a bottle. Always carry about 5 of them with you. Magnesium would be a good one. I would take, if I felt that I was having a stroke, I would pop 2,000 milligrams, 2,500 milligrams of magnesium citrate instantly. Coenzyme Q10, I would take 1,000, 1,500 milligrams. L-carnitine, I'd take 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams if I thought I was having a stroke. Vitamin E, 1,000 units. So it's always important to have a little stroke prevention just in case. All right, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall, out on location. I'm sure many of you are just so frustrated with what's happening in the world of politics, the corruption, the cronyism, the back deal that happens. Just imagine what one person in a few minutes, my guest, went to jail for is completely legal for members of Congress. They'll sit on committees hearing about mergers that they can go and buy. They know in advance that company's going to merge. That means the stock's going to go up. They can buy at an insider's price. And yet that insider trading is legal. Do it on the outside, it's illegal. It's also strange when the Democrats were demonizing Comey that he should be fired. And the Republicans were praising him. Now when Trump fires him, suddenly he is being, you know, lionized. And all it's a flip-flop. It's also foolish. But look around you today. How often have we heard the idea of alternative facts? Let me just give you an example. For decades, those of us in the healing profession and the investigative journalism profession have found repeatedly that mainstream institutions have failed their public mandate and public trust. I'll give you a good example. Death by medicine. I, along with 5 other MDs and PhDs, spent 5 years doing research on a report that would be the definitive report. The AMA did their report, but like everything else, it was very superficial. Said that doctor or medical-induced disease or death was number 3. We found it was number 1, meaning more Americans will die because of the medical community's input, including properly given drugs, than stroke or heart attack or diabetes or cancer. Okay, well, if you're killing that many people every year, low figures around 600,000, high figures 1 million a year in America, After 20 years, no matter how you cut it, you've killed 10 million people didn't have to die, and you've injured over 190 million. Surely, there'd be a meeting. There'd be a conference. There'd be a discussion. The U.S. Public Health Service, its different departments, the National Cancer Institute, the FDA, the CDC, the Surgeon General, they would all get together and say, hey, if we've killed, if American medicine has killed 10 million Americans, shouldn't there be some effort to stop it, to reform it, to change it? Now, here's the interesting part. Those physicians and nurses, dentists and healthcare practitioners who see this problem and step outside of it and try to find other ways that are more natural and non-toxic to help people, those people are condemned. And the facts that they use have no basis in science. So they were criticizing chelation therapy before they had ever actually knew what it was or even tested it. I never will forget once going into a man named Cognom Woods at the American Cancer Society. I'd been given a tip by the former director, and I'll tell you who my source was. My source was Pat McGrady Sr. for 25 years, plus he was the head of public relations for the American Cancer Society. His son, Pat McGrady Jr., who was the head of the Newsweek's Moscow bureau chief, and he was an outstanding award-winning journalist, dropped this on me and said, I'll give you a story. This is in the early 1970s that no one has. The politics of cancer, how the war on cancer is a fraud. This is even before there was an official war on cancer. And I thought that was rather alarming because I'd been out there helping the American Cancer Society down on Wall Street raise money. And I thought if there's any area of medicine that's sacrosanct, it's cancer. Not true. So he showed me all this information about how chemotherapy doesn't work, and they know it, how all the heads of the cancer institutions are on the president's cancer advisory panel, and they get 70% of all the money that the American public gives for cancer. It goes to their own institutions. So the people sitting advising the president advise him to give us the money. And then there was a cancer therapy that had worked, that was non-toxic, and it had been suppressed. And yet they had absolute evidence of it. So I did the story, and the story wouldn't be touched by anyone. No one would touch it, not Mother Jones. No one would touch this. Ms. Magazine, Ramparts, Atlantic, they all were afraid. And so finally, one East Side newspaper published it. It won the Audi Award for investigative journalism for my co-author and myself, Bob Houston, who's a great researcher. And I got to see inside, and it was all putrid. It was corrupt. And so they had a list of doctors who were considered persona non grata, meaning you didn't give them any money, you didn't invite them to speak, you looked at them as quacks. So I went to see this man who kept this list, this like medical McCarthyism list, this blacklist. And so I said, I'm here to see some of the names on the list. You have a Dr. Joseph Issels on the list. Yes. You're calling me a quack. What evidence do you have? Did you go to his clinic? Nope. Ever interviewed any of his patients? No. Have you any firsthand knowledge of what he does? No. Is he a legitimate medical doctor? Yes. Has he ever been found guilty of malpractice or doing anything that was inappropriate, profiting off his patients? No. Then why would he be on your list? He doesn't meet any of your 13 different criteria. Every single doctor I gave him information on that was on the list, there was not one single qualification that would make them a quack, yet they were on there. That's all politics. So I went to visit each of these people, and I saw the truth. So I brought back this truth, and I did a series of articles. One was on 60 Minutes, one was on 2020. In fact, it won two Emmys on Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski. The other was on Dr. Lawrence Burton that was on 60 Minutes. And then Gabe Pressman and others picked up on the stories I was releasing. But here was one set of actual facts, going to a place, interviewing the people, looking at their records, following the patients, interviewing the patients, looking at the scientific literature. They all had something in common. Their therapies were natural, non-toxic, and they were getting better results than anyone in orthodox medicine. Yet it was being suppressed. So that's where medical McCarthyism came in. That's when I saw very clear medical fascism. And so I would do a whole series called Medical Genocide and went after all the different corruption in the medical field. In any case, it finally got to where I wanted to do a report on all of medicine, and it ended up being called Death by Medicine. And we proved in there, using only, exclusively mainstream medicine's own statistics, that it was number one cause of death. So here we had real facts, provable facts, their statistics as our facts. And what the AMA had done, it had excluded people dying of infections in a hospital. That's a big number. People dying of bed sores in hospitals. That's a big number, over 80,000 one year. People dying of malnutrition in hospitals. In one year, it was 50,000. So when you added all the real, and we're only talking about in hospitals. So if you get treated at a hospital and you go home and you die at home, you're not even included in these figures. Or if you're an outpatient, you're not included in these figures. So anyhow, not a single newspaper, scientific journal, not a governmental agency, and we sent it to everyone. We blasted 800 reports out on death by medicine. Not a single person responded. That's what Fritz Perl, the father of Gestalt psychology, calls a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. They didn't want to do anything, so they simply didn't report on it. So when I hear about these alternative facts, what we're looking at today is Orwell's nightmare. It's actually happening today. And I want to share some thoughts from Professor Henry Giroux, because I have such respect for him. Because before we credit Trump with using the great novel as his code book, it's actually the case that George Orwell's terrifying vision of a totalitarian society has been a waking dream in the United States for many years. Any of us who are in the alternative movements, any of us who are social activists, we've seen it. For instance, in 1984, Orwell provided a stunningly prophetic image of a totalitarian machinery of the surveillance state that was brought to life in the 2013 through Edward Snowden's exposure of the mass spying conducted by the United States National Security Agency. The very same security agency that Clapper ran, he was head of all security agencies, and did he not commit perjury in front of Congress? Was he held accountable? Was he condemned? Was he fired? So the media, left and right, jumps all over this, and they condemn Snowden for taking the material and leaking it out to New York Times and WikiLeaks and some of the other papers, The Guardian, actually, at the beginning. But they did not focus upon the actual illegalities that these governmental agents were engaged in. Now, did any of the governmental agents, FBI, CIA, National Security, did any of them go to jail? Were they any of them convicted? Any of them brought? No one. No one's ever, if you're in a governmental agency, no matter what crimes you commit, you're given an immunity. You're given a pass. And that was part of this whole groupthink, this new way of looking, that if you commit a crime and you do it in the name of the United States, whether you're a drone pilot sitting out in a air-conditioned bunker in the desert of Arizona and you're blowing the brains out of innocent civilians, 90% of all drone attacks kill innocent people, are you held accountable? The answer is no. If you're told to assassinate someone by executive order under the National Defense Authorization Act, are you ever held accountable? The answer is no. Well, didn't we have something called the Nuremberg Tribunal that stated that if you know or suspect that what you're asked to do is illegal, you have a right to say no. That was the whole idea. Well, I was just taking orders. Well, just taking orders, if the orders are criminal orders, you can disobey them. Yet no one does. And when someone does have the courage, rarely, but when they do, we go after the person for telling us about the crime, not the people committing the crime. That's pure Orwell. Orwell's genius was not limited to this predictive capacity alone. In addition, his fiction explores how modern democratic populations are won over by authoritarian ideologies and rituals. For example, one of the rituals is every night, these talking heads, both left and right, go on television to condemn the other side. Every single day, Rush Limbaugh will say everything's about the liberals and how bad they are and stupid they are. And every single day, Sean Hannity and Mark Levin, one of the funniest guys on the radio. He's bright and he's funny, but he's such a neocon. But they condemn everything liberal. He just does it by shouting a lot. And we get caught up into thinking that this is reality. It's not reality. It's theater. It's kabuki. These are just clowns who are successful and have people that don't want to do their own critical thinking or investigation who just rely upon them. So they just live by the mantra that I'm on the left, so I'll listen to this person, or I'm on the right, I'll listen to that person. I'm not going to do anything for myself. And that's what authoritarian ideology and rituals want you to believe. They reveal how language specifically function in the service of deception, abuse, and violence. Orwell warned in exquisite and alarming detail how totalitarian practice becomes internalized into totalitarian thinking. And then once you've thought about something and you believe in it, then you can act on it. Hence, that which was sacred in the other person is no longer sacred. Therefore, when we have, I gave an example the other day on the show where we have killings in Belgium, killings in France, it was a horrible act. Innocent people died. That became news for 2 weeks. But at the same time, there were bombings in Iraq and bombings in Yemen where far more people were killed and injured. Nothing. So one group of people, because of their ethnicity, because of their religion, are given a value that others are not. And that's Orwell. And he warned that the mind-controlling totalitarian state took as its first priority a war against what he called thought crimes, nullifying opposition to its authority or simply by controlling access to information, but by undermining the very basis on which critical challenges could be waged and communicated. Orwell illustrated his point by providing examples of language that undermine the critical formative culture necessary for producing thinking citizens central to any healthy democracy. So in recognizing how language fundamentally structures as much as it expresses thought, Orwell made clear how language could be distorted and circulated to function in the service of violence and deception and misuse, and in doing so, utterly collapse any distinction between good and evil, truth and lies. So according to Orwell, totalitarian power drained meaning of any substance by turning language against itself. Do you remember the infamously famous Ministry of Truth, which dissolved politics into a pathology of promoting slogans like war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength? Now extend that today. Disease is healing. All right? Love is murder. So when you go into a doctor's office, you're trusting that doctor is the most experienced person to help you with whatever you're suffering from. But what if the doctor then becomes the primary cause of your death or illness? What if their mistakes are not changed? What if 97% of all chemotherapy fails, as we know it does? And they're using primarily because A, it's the only protocol they know. B, they're profiting off because they can actually buy the drugs at wholesale and sell them to you and make $5,000 to $7,000 per patient. If you're treating 200-300 patients, you're making an extra $2 to $3 million a year. But as long as they control the slogan, the doctor heals, but what about the doctor, the disease, the doctor that kills, the doctor that maims, the doctor that mistreats? We're not allowed that. Hence, we're not allowed to know about death by medicine. We're not allowed to know that statins, you know, can destroy your ubiquinone in the body and destroy your cells' capacity for energy. We're not allowed to know that kids are not born with a pathology of a brain chemical imbalance to which the treatment is Prozac or Ritalin or Dexedrine. But we pathologized everything. So part of the gimmick of totalitarianism is a pathologizing protest. So if you go to protest the cutting down of hardwood forest, the great Sequoia forest, then you are a domestic terrorist. If you protest animal abuse on factory farms, you are domestic terrorist. If you protest Monsanto's GMO and glyphosate used in Roundup, you are domestic terrorist in the eyes of those in authority. That's how totalitarians see you. They don't see you as a sacred human being using your constitutional rights. No. That's how it works. And according to Orwell, once you drain the meaning and substance, then you can say anything and people will believe it. The intersection, if not merger, of a population's culture in the U.S. politics was evident in the frenzied media circus that took place after the Trump assumed the presidency, a fact not lost on the U.S. public. Orwell's novel surged as the number one bestseller on Amazon.com, both in the United States and Canada. And this followed two significant political events. First, remember Kellyanne Conway, Trump's advisor, and a move reminiscent of the linguistic inventions of Orwell's Ministry of Truth, coined the term alternative facts. Well, they're not alternative facts. They're either the truth or variations of the truth. It's a spectrum. Let us now go over to my guest standing by, Michael Kimmelman. He is a former associate attorney at the international commercial business law firm of Sullivan & Cromwell. He later became a stock trader and the founder managing partner of the New York-based hedge fund Incremental Capital. He was among the over the 80 people arrested for insider trading during a far-reaching sting operation led by U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara in 2009 after the financial mortgage meltdown. He was convicted in what I consider personally very flimsy evidence for two counts of security fraud and one for conspiracy for his assumed participation in a large insider trading web with billionaire hedge fund mogul Raj. He spent 2 years in a federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and he's a graduate of Lafayette College and received his law degree from the University of Southern California. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'd like you to begin by with helping the audience with a term that is rarely defined and many people remain confused about, although we hear all the time, insider trading. There are many ways traders can manipulate their investments and handling of traded stocks and derivatives and other exotic financial instruments. It happens all the time, and yet few are caught and tried. And for this reason, popular opinion is that markets are largely rigged until a tipping point is reached when the blocks come tumbling down, such as during the 2008 mortgage meltdown. And we may remember how the larger multinational banks were being deemed insolvent and they were brought back to health by the government, we the people. So to educate the audience as a starter, what are the most common types of insider traders? How widespread is it? And isn't it fair to say that the titans of the banks, such as Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, Brian Moynihan at Bank of America, Citigroup's Michael O'Neill, the top hedge fund managers and the executive brass at the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are perfectly aware of these activities but refuse to do anything because their firms and perhaps even themselves benefit from it? That's my own personal feelings. I'd like yours.
So insider trading, that's a great point that you made. It's never actually been defined by Congress, so there is no statutory definition. What's occurred then in that absence is sort of a patchwork of judge-made law. And unfortunately, as we saw in my case and many other cases, those judges don't always agree on what the law is. My judge was overruled in three future cases that had a lot of people's convictions vacated. But what you have is a large gray area because it has never been adequately defined. And in that gray area, there are obviously cases that are clear violations, such as some of the things that Raj did, such as a Goldman Sachs board member, Rajat Gupta, came out of a meeting when Warren Buffett was going to make an investment into Goldman Sachs and phoned Raj with that information. At trial, he was convicted of making that trade, buying Goldman Sachs on that information because it was going to be obviously very good news. And the stock went up. But then there were also a whole bunch of other areas where not only is insider trading not defined, but it's legal. So, you know, think of commodities, BP or any of these other big firms. They are constantly hedging their book or doing, you know, activities for profit based on insider information that they have as being a major market player in that industry. But if it comes down to, you know, and bonds are the same and some other instruments, but with stocks, it basically means you can't get material, non-public information that is acquired in breach of a fiduciary duty and have obviously knowledge of that information. So there's four or five elements that have to be proven. And how pervasive is it? It's a good question. I mean, we felt it was pervasive before I was arrested. I was a trader, you know, or a portfolio manager for 10 years. And our mantra on the trading desk was somebody always knows. So if you looked at any major corporate event, whether it's earnings or a takeover, a lot of cases, the stock price would begin to tick up or down before there was any public news released about that event. And then, you know, perhaps minutes or hours or even days later, then the news would actually come and you'd say, ah, so that's why the stock was running, you know, up or down. So academic studies have actually shown that something in like 25% of those major corporate events that the news was leaked early or somebody knew of it beforehand. So it was pervasive to a degree. I always thought it was a bane on the market, and, you know, generally it hurt me in my trading activities, and I felt it was unfair. But at the same time, to be able to go out and investigate it and prosecute it and spend the type of resources we did, and let's face it, we were very, you know, almost singularly focused on insider trading during the financial crisis, when in fact, you know, insider trading had nothing to do with the financial crisis whatsoever. But by focusing on this, I think we dropped the ball in a lot of other ways and failed to investigate the real causes or contributions to the financial crisis and overlooked activities like, I don't know, $1 trillion in mortgage fraud or several very big Ponzi schemes like Madoff or Stanford or high-frequency trading, which, again, is a tax on the retail customer and a tremendous misallocation of resources. So there are a lot of other issues out there. I felt that a proper investigative approach would have been more effective and would have yielded perhaps some real targets and some real reforms. But instead, what we got from the U.S. attorney and the Obama administration, I think, was this deliberate whitewash of the causes and contributions of the financial crisis, because obviously it would have indicted congressmen and maybe not a criminal indictment. By indictment, I mean, you know, they would have had to bear some responsibility, but, you know, banks, congressmen, and mostly the regulators, be it the Fed or the ratings agencies, or, you know, the FBI was aware that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud as early as 2004 and did nothing. The Federal Reserve was aware that there was a subprime lending fraud going on and that it was an issue in 2005 and did very little. So a real investigative approach obviously would have yielded a different narrative than this very simple insider trading approach, which they were able to parade, you know, myself and a few others on TV in handcuffs and say, all right, we got these guys. We're on the ball. We're on the case. The public, you know, rest easy. Go back to investing your money. Go back to, you know, nothing to see here, so to speak. So you're right. It's an issue. But again, in the choice of where we allocate our resources, I think it was not the wisest approach.
Michael, can you provide an insider account of what life on Wall Street was like when the 2008 meltdown was underway? And while some people are losing their fortunes, and then give what you know now, what are your personal views about the taxpayers coming to the big banks' rescue, bailing them out, and then knowing they wouldn't be helped? They're no better off today. And yet, more than $16 trillion, and most of it secretly, was given to these big banks. And these big banks have all been shown to have been engaged in illegal activities, yet we, the American people, bailed them out. None of those people went to jail. None were arrested for anything.
Well, it's a particularly sore issue with me in that I ended up paying a $30,000 disgorgement fine and was sentenced to 30 months in prison. And as you mentioned, the big banks collectively were fined for nefarious activities somewhere in the order of $400 billion. And that's billion with a B. And as you mentioned, virtually not a single person went to prison for those activities. So, you know, again, I'm not a math major or math quant, but those numbers don't add up. Again, it's a complicated issue in that in 2008, being on Wall Street, seeing what had happened, it wasn't something that happened overnight. This was a buildup in the system of leverage. It was a buildup of not necessarily deregulation, but inexact and incompetent regulation. And what you had at that point is it's sort of the equivalent of a patient going into cardiac arrest. So while I don't support the manner in which the banks were bailed out, it was, I think, necessary, and there's plenty of disagreement on this issue from others, but I do think it was necessary to come in and stabilize the system and, you know, inject capital into the banks, because we were days or weeks away from a full wide-scale panic where we just haven't seen anything like that. In our society, we've done everything we can to eliminate pain on a day-to-day basis. or any long-term basis. So if it got to the point where we looked like, you know, something like Venezuela, as you see it now, or if you went to an ATM and there was no money there, in our society, it's a very day-to-day society. We have, you know, just-in-time delivery of inventory and everything else. If that whole system of credit and finance and money had broken down, it would have been very, very ugly. So I did support them coming in and stabilizing the system. It could have been done in a more equitable manner. Obviously, there was a lot of bad behavior on the part of banks. Perhaps their equity should have been wiped out, or at least the terms of the bailout should have been significantly more onerous and fair to the taxpayer. But a lot of that money has been paid back. But again, today we're in a situation where these banks are still enormous. And if there was another crisis, I don't think there's any real confidence that they're that much safer or that much better. There's still a too big to fail mantra that's out there that would possibly put the system at risk again. They're definitely more capitalized. The regulators are a little more focused on this. But again, we've already expended a lot of ammunition and a lot of financial bullets at the Fed and elsewhere, injecting money into the system to stabilize it. And again, we're in a much better situation than we were 7, 8, 9 years ago, but the economy hasn't really grown. Yes.
Michael, I would share a difference of opinion. See, mm-hmm. I did the documentary Poverty Inc., and we found 260 million Americans who are living as if they were in Venezuela, who didn't benefit at all from any of the banks being bailed out. All of those banks are bigger than ever before. Now we have this bemoaneth debt potential that the American public would be bailed in on bringing out, and that is derivatives, which is now over $400 trillion, and just five banks. And that was allowed to happen. And that money from that they were given did not go into small businesses, did not go into helping stabilize the mortgage market, people's homes and equities. They just kept making money off money. Today, they're just doing the same thing. So I'm one of those people who believe that all of Wall Street firms that fail should be broken down, allowed to go through structured bankruptcy, allow all the people invested to lose their money as they should. Because if you're a greedy bastard and you're making your money without any thought of how this money is being made and how illegal and unethical and moral it is, then you deserve karmically to lose that damn money. And I don't care who it is. But we have this idea that we must keep saving these bastards on Wall Street. And we got to save these people because without them, the whole world will sink and it won't happen. Will we go through an adjustment? Yes. But the people who are going to be hurt initially will be a lot of those people who would not be continuing to have the power that they have and to be as greedy and selfish and immoral as they are. So I don't see Wall Street as saving our economy. I see it as a threat to our solvency as a planet. Those are my thoughts.
It definitely didn't save the economy. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. It was too large a part of the economy for sure. And I don't disagree with some of the conclusions you drew. I just felt it was something that you had to do after the system was stabilized. So whether that 3 to 6 month period you had to do, you know, the traumatic, you know, right in there and save the system, inject the capital. But then it could have been restructured in a way that's a lot more equitable. You're right. There are hundreds of millions of Americans who benefited not at all and who have been, you know, basically treading water. But that also predates the financial crisis. Their situations got worse for sure. And there's dramatic income inequality. But I don't know what the answer is entirely to that, because it is also, it cuts across the financial sector to the technology sector, to the political spectrum. But you're right. It's something that needs to be addressed and will obviously have cataclysmic consequences if we don't pay attention to it.
Just imagine if we would have spent that $16 trillion by giving no interest loans to small businesses. The largest employers in America are small businesses, not the corporations or federal government. Imagine if we had put that money into infrastructure. Imagine if we had put it into a universal health care and free education. That would have helped the 260 million Americans who are suffering. And not one of them was benefited from these people. My final question, I'm going to need a short answer if you mm-hmm. would. A lot of us believe that the top executives in all these investment banking and hedge fund firms are simply out of touch with reality. Wall Street is its own kind of cultural bubble that hovers above the rest of the planet, in large part due to their wealth and positions of power and consequently their influence at both the levels of finance and government. Can they live and act outside the rules of law that govern the rest of American citizens? And when Lloyd Blankfein declares that he is doing God's work on Wall Street, we have to wonder what kind of God he worships. And recently we had the great American Harvard theologian, Professor Harvey Cox, on this program, who commented on how Wall Street market takes on an omnipotent and all-knowing quality for those who are most immersed in it. And the rewards for having unfavored faith in the market are huge. So speak in your final comments about that.
I think you're right in that people in the financial sector, certainly at the highest level, are very far removed from average Americans and don't relate to them on many levels whatsoever. I think that problem goes far further than just the financial class. I think there is a political class in America, and the two are very deeply intertwined. We've almost become an oligarchy or a royalty class where people are to some degree above the law. And I think we saw a lot of that with Hillary Clinton last year for activities that she did that any other person, including many of the people I was in prison with, were prosecuted and convicted. You know, obviously she had the political clout to avoid that. And I think, again, there is a societal move towards more power, more money going to that top 0.5%, 0.25%, 1%, whatever it is. But if it's not addressed in a way that makes sense, and perhaps you're right, injecting a lot of the capital that went to big banks instead of small business would have been very helpful. As someone who had a small business and somebody who is now an entrepreneur running several small businesses, the system is inherently stacked against the average person. It's almost impossible to stay up to date with all of the regulations and laws, be it taxes, payroll, labor, you name it. They make it very hard for your average person to get a business, to get capital, to get lending. Whereas, again, the giant corporations or giant banks have the political clout and the lobbyists and the lawyers in order to affect their will, whether or not it's good for a greater society. So those are all very pertinent observations by you and things hopefully we can address as a country, and we'll see.
Michael, I'm going to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour because we have a lot more to share. The book that he has written is called Confessions of a Wall Street Insider, a cautionary tale of rats, feds, and banksters. My guest, Michael Kimmelman, K-I-M-E-L-M-A-N. Thank you for being with us, Michael. I look forward to an extended conversation.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.